Hello, everybody, and welcome to Minute 32 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is one of the co-hosts of October Sky Minute, Jim O'Kane. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Happy Tuesday, Rob. Thank you very much for having me back on the show.
I'm glad that you found time to come back. It's always fun talking to you, especially it's one of the great things about talking to you, especially in this movie, is that, you know, you've been to these places. So, you know, I mean, last week I had someone who lives in New York, but he lives in Staten Island. So, you know, he knows the
that
city
barely
a little
counts.
Bit,
yeah.
I know that. So, you know, Eddie talked about when he's been in the city and stuff like that. But, you know, and I talked about last week the fact that I have been at the subway station right next to where, you know, they had to answer the phone, 72nd and Broadway. I've been to that place, but, you know, I was there once. It's not like, you know, it's not like it was a daily commute or anything like that. And the fact that I know that you used to work in Manhattan already, you know, gives us so much more about what's going on here. You know, you can tell us some personal experience of where these places are and what's going on.
This is a little bit north and west of where I used to work at the Radio Shack in the Chrysler Building, which is 43rd and Lexington, or used to be. There's no more Radio Shack there. But when I went to, I used to go to Fordham University up in the Bronx, and I would take the train down from Fordham to Grand Central, and then go to work over at Radio Shack. So most of my work was in Midtown. My mom worked for American Airlines over on 3rd and 39th, so I was all over Midtown a lot. This is a little bit west, but I've been to a lot of places. I had friends that lived out where all this is happening, out on 9th Avenue. And we were talking yesterday about how this is where they're heading right now is down 9th Avenue, which is a pretty broad avenue. As I said before, I thought when I was remembering, I haven't seen this movie in maybe 10 or 15 years. When I was remembering this movie, I could have sworn they were going down Broadway to get, you know, toward south of Soho and things. But once I saw the movie, I thought, oh, that's 9th Avenue. It's a really big, wide avenue, and it's all one way, so you're not competing with traffic coming at you. You know,
you sort of are, because he's
it's slow. If you're trying to get around it, yes. But yeah, not at 60 miles an hour, it's difficult. But it's interesting, and I keep thinking, one block over on 10th Avenue. That's where the famous car chase scene of the Seven Ups happens. So they're a block away from where a northbound car chase is happening. Well, this is funny. This is a car chase where they're calling ahead to get a car to chase, or in this case, an ambulance. It's quite a novel change. I think we're gonna talk a lot today about the hospital that they're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's puzzling. I was having a problem with trying to remember the names of what this were. Roosevelt Hospital is now Mount Sinai. But
right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So minute 32 begins with the taxi taking off once again and ends with John changing his plan. So yesterday we ended things with, you know, John coming to a realization that what he needs to do is call for an ambulance. We're not quite sure why he's doing it. He just tells Zeus that, you know, it's two blocks away, so therefore we can go that direction. And John just floors it at the beginning of this minute. And basically at this point, you know, once again, we see Zeus is really scared, and he screams at McClane and goes, slow the f*** down, McClane. And then, you know, as they're moving through. I mean, John just crashes through Columbus Circle, you know, right through the pedestrian area, and then he, you know, goes to a chain link fence, and we see that he destroys like a whole bunch of bikes. Now, I never noticed, but he's basically he's mostly destroying motorcycles. We're not even talking just about you know, regular bikes, because you see one bike. One bicycle go flying, but I was able to count six motorcycles that he basically runs right over.
Wow. Wow. I don't recall ever seeing a motorcycle in Manhattan. I can't imagine trying that too, because I mean, there's so many between all the bumps in the road and the manhole covers and the steam pipes and things. That would be worse than off-roading.
My assumption is that that's why everyone parks them. That's why everyone parks them in Columbus Circle.
Yeah, they jump on the subway and take it in for the rest. Yeah, that's their commuter lot, I guess.
I guess so. Now, do you know how far back the idea of a motorcycle goes? When do you think the first motorcycle was created?
I would think it was before the Wright brothers, but after, let's see, I would go for maybe Civil War times, maybe 1860s or 70s.
Well, the 1860s is when they started having steam engine motorcycles. Wow. But they didn't make very many of them. They, you know, in 1867, there was a steam engine motorcycle that they made one.
Okay.
And then a few years later, they made another. Then, you know, they changed it a little bit and they called it a velocipede. And they once again made one. And then in 1885, they decided, okay, steam wasn't going to work. They made one out of petroleum internal combustion, which, once again, let's see if you can guess how many they made.
I'll double it. Oh, okay. I would have gone with two, but oh, well. Half right.
They made one.
Wow.
Yes. So in 1887 was when they started making things that look more familiar to what we're talking about. So the modern configuration basically was started in 1887. And then a company called Hildebrand and Wolfmuller created in 1894 a machine, and they actually first called it a motorcycle.
Wow. Imagine, like, if they had gone big instead of Harley Davidson, that you'd have to wear really big motorcycle jackets just to have the name on the back of the jacket. Seriously.
That's right. Now, do you know where the name motorcycle comes from?
I think cycle would be Greek, so I don't know. Motor and cycle.
It actually was originally, it came from the German, Motorrad.
Hmm.
And then they decided to... And so the first motorcycle that was produced in the U.S. was the Orient Aster, which was built by Charles Metz in Waltham, Massachusetts in 1898. Wow. So, I mean, and we're not even going to how far back bicycles go, because bicycles go a lot longer. But, during World War One, the motorcycle started changing a lot of the way things were being done during war, because, you know, you can get places a little bit faster than you were able to beforehand, because, you know, they were still starting with cars, but a motorcycle is much easier to maneuver,
especially for the roads that were available at the time. I would think, you know, the great messengers would be able to use them a lot easier.
That's right. Now, how many So the type of motorcycle that was mostly used during World War One by the Allies or by the British was the Triumph motorcycles. And how many of them do you think that they sold to the Allied forces to use during World War One?
Well, definitely more than one. So I'll go with 2,000.
30,000.
Wow.
Yeah. That's
an army in itself. Wow.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
Completely. Yeah,
I mean, imagine trying to gear up the production of that while you're there's a war going on. You're trying to say, well, I'm gonna build this motorcycle and it's gonna work, and I get all the parts out and get it out to the troops. Holy smokes! Wow.
Yeah, and obviously, the company Harley Davidson became the largest manufacturer of motorcycles by 1920, and even at that point, they were selling them in 67 countries.
Wow.
Didn't Hiltz ride a Triumph in the when he was trying to get over the fence?
Was it a Triumph or a BMW? Yeah, I guess it was a Triumph. That's right. Yeah.
I think it was a Triumph. Yeah. So you see, call back to season one.
There you go.
we can see a bunch of bikes on the side that got away safely, that weren't run over by John McClane's driving abilities. And at this point, then as I said, John goes through like the pavilion area and, just takes out another fence as he's going across. And in some ways, it reminded me of Frogger. Okay, the way that he's like running, the way that he's driving across the, I mean, again, this goes back to what we were talking about yesterday about the amount of organization needed to make something like this work. It's just unbelievable. Wow. You know, that no one hit John's car. I mean, you can hit other cars.
Yeah.
You can't hit, that's a no-no. And then we get a quick shot of Ricky, and he gets stuck in traffic and stops his car, and we this is the only time we actually get to see that Ricky has a passenger. There's some unnamed assuming detective that's in the car with him. I had always thought that he was in the car alone. That we had Connie and Joe in the van, and then we had Ricky here, but apparently. We get a glimpse of a partner, which is a character we never see, or I haven't noticed up until now. Maybe we'll see him later on or something like that. And Ricky just stares as John decides to basically drive on the sidewalk again. And we see him like run through a cafe, and we see the tables go flying and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's no fruit vendor with a bunch of apples and shaking his fist as he goes by. That's the typical one in all these crashing scenes on a sidewalk stuff.
That's right. But those are mostly in comedies, aren't they?
Do it that way. I mean, you could say some of this is a comedy, but it's all over the top stuff. I mean, and there's always the guys that are carrying a large plate glass window across the street.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And then the shot changes and we see an ambulance pulling into the shot. And then we see in the background, like a block away, we see a taxi come in, skidding down the road.
Yeah, great shot.
And then he comes up behind the ambulance. That's right.
Yeah.
And then John says to Zeus, he goes, kind of like football, isn't it? And he goes, what? He says, get yourself a blocker and head for the end zone, which is great. It's nice the way that they do that. John is following this ambulance very, very closely. Is it illegal to do this?
I would think that, don't they usually have a sign on the back, keep back 200 feet and stuff? I would think that might be a tailgating issue, although I have to say that I did get stuck in traffic once, and I followed a fire truck down Grand Central Parkway. There was some traffic built up, and I followed behind it. But this was many years ago, and I'm sure the statute of limitations has lifted by now.
Yeah, well, I mean, what it comes down to is, first of all, it is not illegal to do so. It might be a not a nice thing to do. Everyone's going to be upset at you for doing it. But you are allowed to theoretically follow a police car or a fire engine or an ambulance or something like that. But what's illegal is you can't go through red lights like they can.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And you can't disregard traffic signs and stuff like that. So the idea is you have to, still follow regular laws. John doesn't care because he's a cop and he can still get away with
it. Yeah, he's got his badge and a gun now, so he's all set. he can do these things when back in the saddle. Right. Like,
yeah, exactly. So there's no problem with him doing that. And it's great again because we see that Zeus's fingers are still attached to the dashboard. As he's doing this, he's still holding on for dear life. Yesterday he crossed himself. Last week he was holding on to the dashboard. He's back crossing, holding the dashboard. I think he probably thinks that holding the dashboard is a little safer.
Yeah.
Than crossing yourself.
a good brace position at least.
That's right. And we see that they actually pass a sign of a supermarket that says A&P.
Oh.
So do you know, first of all, what A&P stands for and what the history of it is?
Yes, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which was one of the first supermarkets that was a franchise operation. The A&P was a major, really a major force in most of the 20th century in American merchandising for grocery stores. They had their own. They also had their own house brands, including Ann Page. Notice the name Ann Page, like Betty Crocker with AP. So they. Their house brand was Ann Page for many of their baked goods. They came out with 8 o'clock coffee, a name that's outlived the supermarket itself. 8 o'clock coffee was fresh ground coffee in the store that they would bag and sell, much like Starbucks is nowadays. The A&P had a major commercial presence on radio. They had the A&P Gypsies, who were two people that talked about sales at A&P. They even came out with Woman's Daily, which was an early newspaper built for women shoppers that had a lot of A&P ads in them that they sold at the point of sale next to the cash register, which is where if you go in at most stores today, if you see like the National Enquirer and the Globe and all these other things next to them, that all started with Woman's Daily, which was an A&P publication. That's some of what I know about A&P, but I'm sure
that's great. Looking stuff up. Yeah. Do you know what year A&P started?
I would guess sometime in the turn of the century.
1859.
Wow, that early. Okay.
Yeah, really, it shocked me. And they actually closed their doors in 2015. But from 1915 to 1975, it was the largest grocery retailer in the U.S., and up until 1965, it was the largest U.S. retailer of any kind.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. The amount of, by 1878, they had 70 stores.
Wow.
Which was mostly in New York, and then they started expanding. It's amazing that something like that has just it just blew up to proportions that nobody probably expected at that point or ever.
No, I mean being an early market leader and figuring it out before everybody else, they had such a head start on these things. Just a brilliant plan. I grew up. As we've talked before, I grew up in the New York, New Jersey area, and A&Ps were everywhere, and that was the place to go. You get, good prices that were, and their house brands were not second rate. They were very, very good quality. You buy a can of peas that were A&P brand peas are just as good as the Del Monte's or whatever, whatever the brand name was. So they didn't skimp on quality when they sold at good prices.
It's true. So yeah, it's pretty amazing history that they have for that. And at this point, they continue chasing after the ambulance. I guess you could sort of call them ambulance chasers, even though they're not lawyers. So it's a little bit different. And then Zeus says, "If you'd said Wall Street, we could have followed them all the way." And then John says, "Wrong. South of 14th Street's a different hospital." "Oh," he goes, "St. Luke. Hang on." And he makes a quick turn as he's doing. Now, what's really amazing is the fact that, first of all, John shows that how street smart he is once again with this line. The fact that he knows that depending on where you are, that's where, that's going to tell you which hospital is going to show up. The ambulance is going to come from a certain hospital and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that when he said St. Luke's, which the only St. Luke's I knew was way up in Harlem or west of Harlem, like off of Amsterdam Avenue and around, I think around 110, 112th Street up that way. But there may be several St. Luke's. A lot of these are, well, such as the way that Roosevelt is now Mount Sinai, which is part of several hospitals. I would think that if he were that far south, they would have called either Beth Israel over on 14th or St. Vincent's, or probably the nearest one to 14th would be Presbyterian, the big one over on Fulton Street. But he is right. I would assume that he would know where the ambulances came from, because he is from the New York NYPD is divided into two sections. Everything north of the Plaza Hotel where we just landed, that was kind of the demarcation line. Everything north of the where the park starts at the south end, that's called Manhattan North, and the NYPD takes care of that section in Manhattan, the Manhattan North district. And then below that is Manhattan South. So McClane, I think, is from Manhattan South, because most of his stuff is happening downtown. So I would think that he's from Manhattan South, so he would know the area better. But I would think that if somebody is, you know, if you had an officer down, that you'd call, they'd call for an ambulance from Presbyterian on Fulton Street. But again, it wouldn't work with this movie. So whatever saying. And of course, this is also. I didn't live in New York in the 90s, so there may have been changes of who owns what hospital nowadays. So he might have the names might have changed since I lived there in the 70s.
Okay, well, first of all, they have. Okay, so okay. That's why I wanted to wait until today to talk also about Roosevelt. So Roosevelt Hospital, which they mentioned yesterday, was opened in 1871. And it's Midtown West, and they got that one right of more or less where that is. Okay, the thing is that in 1979, Roosevelt Hospital and St. Luke's merged.
Oh, okay.
And it became St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center. And then in 2013, the hospitals together became part of the Mount Sinai Health System.
Right.
Okay. People got upset. So in 2015, they actually changed the name back to St. Luke's Roosevelt. They changed the whole name because it's Mount Sinai St. Luke's. Yeah, they keep changing the names.
The sign probably hangs out over the street to fit all the names in there. Because I was thinking if you said Mount Sinai, I'd be headed to the Lower East Side, because there was a Mount Sinai down on the Lower East Side when I lived there. But now it's a health system now.
Right. Just what I thought was really funny is the fact that, you know, you have both Mount Sinai and St. Luke's that merged. And John says, no, you got to use St. Luke's if you want to go downtown as opposed to uptown and that thing. So, it's possible that in 1994 or 1995 when Jonathan Hensley wrote this, maybe, you know, at that point there was something, but it's just very funny the fact that he uses two names of hospitals that merged. I mean, during week one with Jay, we talked all about the various hospitals, the hundreds of hospitals all around New York. So, you know, we're not going to go back there again.
I just think of downtown, I think of the only song I can think of with a hospital in it from New York is the Billy Joel song "Moving Out," and he talks about he works at Mr. Cacciatore's down on Sullivan Street across from the medical center. That's Presbyterian, because it's around the back side of the village.
But he couldn't have said Presbyterian Medical Center. Yeah. It wouldn't have rhymed as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it wasn't. Yeah, it's not something that pops into your head when you're trying to chase an ambulance.
Yeah, yeah, and come on, it's Billy Joel, so
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so can't complain about that. At this point, John then once again asks Zeus, he goes, "Time," and Zeus goes, 10:02. And John says, "We're halfway there with 18 minutes to go." And then John just looks to the side and goes, "F this." And then basically, we see that he turns to the side. And I mean, we'll have to wait until tomorrow to find out exactly what it is that he's now going to do. He's got some other plan. You know, he's realized that he's got 18 minutes left. So we'll have to wait and see, tomorrow what the rest of John's plan is for that. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Let's see. No, I think we covered it pretty well.
Okay, great. So let's get into the script a little bit about some of the changes there. There's a few, not many. So it says Roosevelt Hospital established daytime, uneventful. A nurse wheels a patient up the entrance ramp. Suddenly, the hospital's EMS garage door rolls open and an EMS ambulance roars out onto 9th Avenue, heading south. Its sirens blaring, whoop, whoop, whoop. Across the street, the taxi comes flying around the corner, fishtailing onto 9th Street, falling in behind the ambulance. McLean says, "That's the ticket. Pick up some blockers, then go for the end zone." McLean punches the accelerator, following the ambulance. Aerial shot 9th Avenue down the west side. All the way down 9th Avenue, cars pull to the curb. The side street traffic halts as the ambulance sirens wailing, roars through intersection after intersection, running interference from McLean and Zeus in the taxi. McLean drops the hammer, 40 miles an hour, 50, 60. Block after block flies by. Zeus looks at McLean, impressed. "Why 14th Street? If you would have said Wall Street, we would have had them the whole way." McLean, "Emergency calls below 14th Street are taken to a different hospital, St. Luke's." "Well, aren't you the one slick mother?" McLean guns the car, and the ambulance reaches 14th Street and 9th Avenue, skids to a stop in the intersection. Paramedics scramble out, looking frantically around for the officers down. McLean veers to avoid the ambulance in front of him. He clears it and accelerates through the intersection. "How much time?" Zeus looks at his watch. "It's 5:02. We're halfway there with 18 minutes to go. What do you think?" So just to remind everyone in the script, this is taking place in the late afternoon. For some strange reason, they use the time of late afternoon, but they keep saying it's morning. So it's very strange. McLean says, "I don't know. We're hitting traffic again." McLean thinks for a moment. "Yes." McLean bangs a left on 12th Street. And that's where it ends. So again, it's pretty much the same. I don't know why they need to show us the little bit of the point with, someone, a nurse coming out of the hospital, but whatever, doesn't really make a difference from that perspective. Okay. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five, trilogies. So Jim, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay. My, I'm playing fast and loose with the rules because I know these are trilogies.
Oh, you can always do that. That's
okay.
Fine.
Well, I always go with the first three of any, there might've been further ones, but, I'll mention that with, I'll start it off explaining this idea, because the trilogy, that I enjoy a lot that actually has five movies attached to it is Dirty Harry. Of course, the original Dirty Harry, followed by Magnum Force, followed by The Enforcer. I think those are a perfect trilogy. Adding in Sudden Impact and Deadpool, I don't even consider them as regular Dirty Harry films, because Clint wasn't acting like Dirty Harry in those films. Magnum Force is a bit weak. It's a weak middle, but it does finish strong. But Dirty Harry, that Dirty Harry universe is beautiful, and it's really Clint Eastwood as one of his best characters. When you think of him, you think Dirty Harry immediately. So he set the tone for the rest of his career there, even though he was well into his career. He got away from westerns with that one. I'm not sure if this counts as a trilogy, but I think of it as a trilogy.
Anything counts as a trilogy. As long as there are three movies, okay.
It was the same, same producer, same production company, and the same two actors, but they're playing different roles, different times. And that was true with Simon Pegg's group. I didn't include him. There was a close one with
the Cornetto,
Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and World's End, but. It's from the 70s, and I used to go to the movies a lot when I was a kid in the 70s. Every Friday night, for $1, I'd go to the Cameo Theater in Brewster, New York, and watch a bunch of movies there. And I enjoyed Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby in three films that are just – they're funny. You don't have to think too hard, and they're clever. They're clever in their own right. Uptown Saturday Night, the starter for that. Then Let's Do It Again. And a piece of the action, and they're playing very different roles in it. But seeing Sidney Poitier in a comedy you don't usually get that. And they're very funny movies. I mean, we all, you know, it's Bill Cosby back when he was just Bill Cosby and didn't have all the other stuff we found out about Bill Cosby later. But it's funny, just funny films in themselves. I enjoy those kind of don't have to think too hard comedy movies. And then the top three trilogies at that. Yeah, you can three threes. The top three easily the definition of a great trilogy. Back to the Future. I think 1, 2, and 3. It's surprising. It always surprises me when I listen to the director's commentary about how Bob Gale didn't think they were going to have a trilogy, that he really wasn't planning on it. And, you know, it seems now when you watch them, it just seems perfectly natural that it's one big story divided into three parts. But being able to tack on those last two and still make it feel organic is amazing to me. I enjoy them. There's the top two trilogies for me that people, I know they argue about which one goes on top of it, but I would say Indiana Jones, the first three movies of Indiana Jones being Raiders, Temple of Doom, and Last Crusade. Great films. Temple of Doom to me is weak, but it's still effective. It has all the elements of a good indie movie, and it didn't outstay its welcome. I think the first three movies were really great in not overstaying their welcome. They're very entertaining, solid screenplay, solid performances, and great editing. And of course, number one, you have to go with the original Star Wars trilogy. I don't think you can avoid putting Star Wars in there as a trilogy, unless you say, well, they're not a trilogy anymore. But as a trilogy, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Last Jedi. It's
not
solid.
Not The Last Jedi, Return of the Jedi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at, you know what it is? I'm looking at this paper and I've written down all the ones, not Last Jedi. Yeah. I'm looking down at the bottom. Return of the Jedi, 1983. I don't know if it's a function of I'm an old guy and I saw these in the movie theater, but I feel very attached to them at a certain age. You know, I was a teenager when Star Wars came out, and, I can remember waiting impatiently for Empire. Every little scrap, this was before the internet, every little scrap of information, you'd see a little thing, you'd see a picture of Luke Skywalker on the back of his town, or you'd see, you know, they'd all be wearing fur coat, you know, fur parkas and things like that, and you're like, what's this going to be about? And, you know, we didn't see Yoda, we didn't know who, we heard about Yoda, never saw Yoda, and we saw like the asteroid field, and it was like that whole sequel, I can still feel the anticipation of it, just waiting for it to come out. And then, you know, when we saw Han Solo encased in carbonite, you knew he was coming back, but you didn't know how they were going to do it. So that long wait from 1980 to 1983, it came out just before my son was born. It was the last movie I saw before I was a dad. And oh, wow. So kind of like a last bit of, I don't want to say childhood, but a last bit of, I don't have responsibilities. This is my, you know, this is still a fantasy world. And so that was the last film that I saw as not a dad. And it's interesting seeing it now, because I remember the feeling I had there saying, well, this is, you know, a whole new world's going to be opening up. And it did. So, but yeah, those, maybe it has personal connection with me. And I know that Star Wars has a personal connection with billions of people across the globe, but yeah. It's very touching. So anyway, those are my five trilogies.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that. So Jim, why don't you tell people once again where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Well, right now we are doing a great show called The October Sky Minute. It's Joe Johnston's 1999 feature film from Universal Pictures. And we have an amazing guest list. I can't go through so many of them here. We have a guy that's going to do the first walk in space, probably about the same time that you're listening to this. If you hear of Jared Isaacman, he's a guest star on our show to talk about space. We have everybody in coming to talk about everything from NASA historians, actors that were in the movie, and even the guy that the movie is a subject of, Homer Hickam, is a good friend and a frequent guest on our show. So please join us, OctoberSkyMinute.com.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to my podcast, my views, and listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, moveaboutminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send an email to moveaboutminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Johnny comes marching home again, hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.